Hello again. I'm going to take you back to history. In January 2005, recent history, I stumbled upon an exhibition in the Pergamon Museum titled Bagdadban und Hijazban, originally organized by the Deutsche Bundesbahn Museum in Nuremberg. The exhibition looked at railroad construction in the Ottoman Empire exclusively from the German point of view and using only German documents. At the end of this exhibition, you would say, wow, these Germans, they really wanted to help Muslims to go to Hijaz and make their travel so easy. In any case, the exhibition covered the construction of two lines up to the present day and complemented the historic documents with a series of photographs shot by Helmut Dollhaupt in 2000. In one vitrine, some antique fragments were displayed, the wall text explaining that the concession given to the German company by the Ottoman authorities around the turn of the century specified the procedures to be followed if antiquities were found on the sites. They had to be sent to the Imperial Museum in Istanbul. The wall text went on to explain that these were the kind of materials unearthed during the construction and that the concession was referring to, obviously ignored by the German company. I kick myself for not photographing that caption and the vitrine. Well, we Turks are very familiar with such stories. Jumping over a century, just last month, on August 10 to be exact, I read in the Daily Hürriyet a news piece titled, "We Have the Head, Germany Has the Body." According to the article, around 1900, a French railroad engineer, Paul Gauguin, had sent a small number of Roman artifacts he had found in the Hadrianus Baths in Aphrodisias to the museum in Istanbul, at the same time smuggling the rest and selling them out of the country. Years later, in the late 1980s, Professor Kenan Erim, working on the same site, discovered a marble head, 33 centimeters high and weighing 5 kilos. Upon further research, Professor Erim figured out that the bottom half of the statue, tenderly called in Turkish İhtiyar Balıkçı, the old fisherman, was in the Pergamon Museum. The Turkish authorities asked for the return of the piece in 1991 to receive the routine response that the museum had paid for the statue 100 years ago and was not returning it. Turkey repeated its request twice since then, in 2013 and 2014, and was rejected both times. Capitalizing upon the declaration of Aphrodisias as a UNESCO World Heritage Site in July 2017, Turkey pushed again for repatriation. The saga continues, and it's a very common saga. Now, the railroads, the Imperial Museum in Istanbul, and Ottoman laws on antiquities have an intertwined history, and I'm going to talk about this history a little bit here. The painting on the screen by Jean-Baptiste Hilaire dates from 1789. At first sight, it seems to depict the picturesque skyline of Istanbul, very innocently. But a more careful look reveals another story that takes place in the foreground, that is the transportation of antiquities lying on the quay to a foreign boat under the direction of a European man. Let me show you. Oops, I did it again. Go back. All right. Here we are, the Europeans. Their antiquities are lying here, and they're going to the boat nicely waiting for them. The collection is indeed that of Count Choiseul Gauffier on its journey to France. Choiseul Gauffier was the French ambassador to the empire at the time. And the story, we know this story in quite some detail. Now, 100 years later, such an operation would be out of the question. Ottomans were not welcome actors to the field of archaeology and museology for understandable reasons. Their forceful entry with a series of laws from 1869, 1874, 1884, and 1906 increasingly restricted the activities of European and American archaeologists, imposed mandatory permissions for any kind of work within the imperial boundaries, controlled the operations on the field, and banned the exportation of antiquities. In an essay dating from 1883 and on the eve of the planned changes to the 1874 laws, Solomon Reinach reflected a commonly shared view by Western scholars when he voiced a strong opposition to the tightening of Ottoman attitudes toward antiquities. Published in the widely circulated Revue des Deux Mondes under the catchy title of Le Vandalisme en Orient, the article's central argument underlined that, quote, the antiquities of the Greco-Roman Orient were of no interest to their new masters, the Turks, and that Europe, the heir to the civilization of Greeks, had to impose the responsibility and the honor of taking back the monuments from them, unquote. Reinach continued, the Ottoman laws were not fair to European researchers. The Ottoman state did not have the means to afford the preservation and maintenance of the antiquities, besides not having any interest on them. The Turkish race had its own national art, he maintained, which had nothing to do with the Greco-Roman past. Reinach's call had no resonance on the Ottoman front. If anything, it had the reverse effect. Under the leadership of Osman Hamdi Bey, a prominent intellectual, artist, and self-educated archaeologist, Europeans were self-educated as well, the historic wealth found in the far-flung territories of the empire was appropriated into the official heritage. The most visible symbol of this development was the new building for the Imperial Museum of Antiquities in Istanbul, designed by Alexandre Valori and opened in 1891. With its centerpiece, the sarcophagi from Sidon, excavated by Osman Hamdi Bey himself, who served also as the director of the museum, it was to house pieces from all over the empire and serve as a platform for international scholarly debate. Osman Hamdi's personal and passionate identification with the museum famously echoed in his words, Il n'y a pas de bassesse que je ne passe pour mon musée. I can do anything for it. His efforts remain geared toward a small international group of academics, and he relied on this group for publicizing his work. The Western archaeologists, in turn, were forced to comply with Hamdi Bey as he had the keys to their research. The collections of the Imperial Museum entered the academic discourse very fast, making a spectacular debut with the contribution of the Sidon sarcophagi to the heated debates on polychromy in antiquity. As you can see from the drawings on the right, these sarcophagi are painted. The laws complicated the conditions on the excavating sites. The 1874 law had designated local authorities in the provinces to control the activities of foreign archaeologists holding permissions and stipulated the division of the findings between the archaeologist, the Imperial Museum, and the owner of the land. The 1884 law revised the partage policy by requiring all objects found on the site to be documented and given over to the museum, and inserted another level of supervision by implementing a delegate of government officers acquainted with the necessary knowledge to assist on excavation sites. So, when we look at the photograph on the screen, we see all the actors on the site, and it's a complicated dynamic. We have the three Germans here, we have the Turkish officer, and then the workers. Let me show you one more. Here, the American archaeologist in Sardis, the Turkish civil servant, and then back in there, the workers chipping away. Now, this became a big nuisance for foreign teams on several levels. An article particularly hostile to Hamdi Bey's strict surveillance of antiquities argued that the Ottoman public servants in the provinces could be bought for money on any occasion except on the subject of antiquities. The consequences were sad for scholarly societies like the American Institute of Archaeology, ready to spend, quote, thousands on the excavation at Babylon, for example, and be expected to be content with the honor and glory of enriching Hamdi's museum without acquiring one iota for themselves, unquote. In New York Times' relatively more temperate language, the most disagreeable thing, this time to the American team working in Nippur, was that a Turkish official had to accompany any exhibition to take charge of all objects found. Foreign archaeologists now had to accommodate an individual whose unique job was to watch their activities. Furthermore, aside from places where digs were carried out, all antique sites were guarded by government appointees. Prompted by certain unfortunate events, authorities in Istanbul took one more step and requested that all civil servants, high school principals, education inspectors, and teachers be alert to the theft of antiquities, as in the aftermath of the lifting of four sculptures from Nimrud in 1898 by German archaeologists. Now, I'm being very unfair to these German archaeologists because these are not the ones who lifted the antiquities, but I think the photographs are very good in showing how much they loved them. A regulation on the duties and responsibilities of guards shows the intended level of supervision on foreigners. The guards on any site were to accompany the visitors during the entirety of their time on the grounds and make sure that they did not even take the smallest of stones, did not photograph the sites and the old fragments, and did not make casts. At least on paper, these are the rules. The level of surveillance encompassed railroad construction. In concessions given to foreign companies to build railroads, the regulation stipulated that if antiquities were found during the operations, the museum in Istanbul should be immediately notified and laws applied. For example, the act of the Railroad Company of Syria, which was responsible for the construction of the Damascus-Haifa line in 1891, stipulated that the concessionaire had to report all antiquities and art objects found during the construction to the Ottoman administration, and a separate request had to be made to obtain authorization for archaeological research. The news would be sent to the authorities by means of a telegraph line to be built along the entire length of the line at the expense of the company, and I'm showing you just one of these. Okay. The extension of the measures to railroad construction meant that even workers were charged to keep an eye on antiquities. Under guidance from the Directorate of the Imperial Museum in Istanbul, the Ottoman Ministry of Education had created a network of espionage, in the words of an American observer. The extensive telegraph network of the empire facilitated the work of the espions, and this map is even earlier than the dates I'm talking about. It's from the mid-1870s, but it shows you the extent of the telegraph network. The Imperial Museum benefited from these measures to accommodate the growing collections. It was expanded twice between 1899 and 1908, resulting in a U-shaped building around the 16th century pavilion, the tiled kiosk used also as part of the museum. Now, this is that 16th century pavilion. The original building is here, and then the two wings are on the two sides. Let me show you this expanded version from the exterior, which contrasts quite a bit from the first photograph I showed you of the museum. And here is a view from the interior. Not all antiquities could be transported to Istanbul, and some stayed behind. But there, the process was set by the Directorate of Imperial Museum. The newly found artifacts were to be transported to closest high schools. After being photographed, the most important among them would be sent to the Imperial Museum in Istanbul. The rest would be exhibited permanently in the courtyards and hallways of high schools, turning them into provincial museums. For example, the Imperial Museum in Jerusalem, whose Ottoman era stretches from 1901 to 1917, was sheltered in a high school built in 1893. One room was dedicated to the museum. The Ottoman emergency formula to find homes for antiquities led to the use of other official buildings. Government palaces were second choices after high schools. Beirut's government palace, sometimes called the Petit Palais or the Petit Serail, dating from 1884, the year of the big change in the laws, was a matter of great pride for Ottomans. Located at the vista of a new municipal park adjacent to the Old Town and designed by the chief engineer of the province, Bishar Efendi, the palace was in the style of old castles, and extraordinary attention had been paid to its exterior and interior planning and decoration, citing Ottoman records. On the right, we have the municipal garden with the building in the background, and here is the building itself. It's no longer there. The Baedeker Guide to Syria and Palestine reported that the courtyard of the Petit Palais was used as an open-air museum for antiquities found in the region. I don't have a plan of this building, but you can see it here in the site plan, and there is a courtyard, and here is a photograph showing the antiquities. Other unlikely government buildings shared in the mission as well, as mockingly reported by the French Mandate authorities a couple of decades later. The southwestern Anatolian city of Adana did not have a museum proper, but in the new and spacious police headquarters built in the 1890s, several rooms and the courtyard were used as display areas. So in parentheses, I would suggest that we're talking about an alternative museum, an alternative genre of museum created by the Ottomans in the considering the financial difficulties and the political complexities of the region. Now, railroads were crucial for transporting antiquities to the Imperial Museum. After all, many important archaeological sites, especially in the Aegean region and in Syria, were along the rail lines. For example, the village of Sart near Sardis was on the Izmir-Afyon line in the Aegean, and the Hijaz Railroad passed close to Baalbek. Rail transportation increasingly became a necessity on the archaeological sites themselves to increase the scale and speed of the excavations. In Sardis, for example, a train was essential in order to remove the heavy crane that you see on the top on the left from place to place. The heavy train lifted and carried huge blocks of marble abundant on the site. Yet, to bring the train to the site proved to be a bureaucratic challenge. The American archaeologists had to maneuver around a possible conflict with the government, as, I'm quoting, even a small and temporary railway between the town of Sart and the village near the ruins would interfere with the Turkish railway regime, according to the regulations of concessions given by the state to the railway company. To avoid trouble, only 100-meter stretches were constructed at a time, making the transportation process cumbersome and fragmented. You can see that finally they did bring the rails to the construction site. Howard Cosby Butler, the archaeologist in charge, explained the process with sarcasm. The engineering staff, without any outside assistance, constructed the roadbed from Sart to the excavations, assembled the parts of the locomotive, put the wagons together, made up a train, and loaded it with extra rails and other equipment. The train was moved forward a little over 100 meters. Then the laborers would pick up the line in long section and move them in front of the train. Exactly 10 days were consumed in this entire operation. And on the 11th, the locomotive, adorned with evergreens and flowers, brought the train triumphantly into the excavations. Moving to Baalbek. Baalbek had made the news with the visit of Kaiser Wilhelm II in 1898. Memorialized by a plaque placed on a wall in the Temple of Jupiter. Opened with much fanfare and photographed profusely, the plaque celebrated the Ottoman-German cooperation and the friendship between Wilhelm II and Abdülhamit II. Travel to Baalbek was facilitated by the railroad lines, and the Ottoman press reported that thousands of foreign travelers came every year, spending considerable amounts of money. Baalbek is marked on the map, which is drawn, I believe I took it from one of the Salname's yearbooks, Ottoman yearbooks, and the painting, lovely painting on the right, is just one of the many, many, many depictions of Baalbek by European and American artists. This one is by John Singer Sargent, watercolor from 1905. A new venue of travel was opened up when tourism was oriented toward Ottomans in articles that read like short invited travelogues filled with practical tips in popular press to the Turkish-speaking Ottomans. Nevertheless, tourism came with its own problems. Osman Hamdi had angrily noted that the visitors had their names inscribed on the walls and the columns. They were covered in large letters with names of, quoting Hamdi Bey, French, English, Russian, and American scholars, ministers, ambassadors, gallant ladies, and all kinds of travelers. To protect the monuments, he had to take serious administrative measures. Security was increased, the compound was closed off with a fence, and entrance tickets were issued, several guards were appointed. Trains which worked hard to furbish the Imperial Museum and to bring economic benefits from growing number of tourists played also a counterproductive role. On the eve of World War I, in an article titled Theft of Antique Works and Islamic Art in Ottoman Lands, Mukbil Kemal, an Ottoman intellectual, complained about how well railroads served illegal trade because, he argued, they smoothly allowed the transportation of stolen objects to European museums in crates away from the sites. In the past, he argued, their removal and transportation was much more blatant and could be reported to the authorities much more easily. So, once again, Ottoman railroads opened charged perspectives to the past with, I think, serious implications for the present. Thank you.